来嘛来嘛，不要输了，等你的，不要输了，等你的，来嘛来嘛，哎，来哎来哎来哎，不要输了，等你的，扛起来。
Welcome to New Books in Southeast Asian Studies on iTunes and via the web. I'm Nick Cheeseman, a research fellow at the Australian National University's College of Asia and the Pacific. Today, it's my pleasure to be talking with Alison Truitt, an associate professor in the Department of Anthropology at Tulane University, about her neatly titled book, Dreaming of Money in Ho Chi Minh City, published in 2013 by the University of Washington Press. Alison, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
In the book's introduction, you write that you first arrived in Ho Chi Minh City in 1996, having lived in Hanoi for several months. People in Hanoi had warned you about the city. They cautioned you to hold your cash close to your body, to leave your gold jewelry at home, and so on. And nevertheless, despite their warnings, you returned to Ho Chi Minh City in the year 2000, and you say that this time you went to look for money. So what was it that you were doing, looking for money, and why Ho Chi Minh City?
When I first went to Vietnam, I studied in Hanoi. And I think at that time, there was a popular perception, which has since been subject to critique, that in order to understand Vietnam, you need to start in Hanoi. And that perception, I think, was particularly strong for people who were going, as I was, initially to learn the language. So the idea, of course, was that the language that you would study was the standardized version of Vietnamese. And of course, that understanding, as I said, has been critiqued. But I went down to Ho Chi Minh City after having studied in Hanoi, and the city was overwhelming for me. And so actually I am surprised in retrospect that I returned. I remember on the very last day I was in Ho Chi Minh City, there was a tremendous storm and the entire city just seemed to flood. And I was wondering if I would get back and get to the airport and be able to return to the United States. But I did, and I later took part in a brief research project that was on the gender dynamics. And I was struck by the interviews that we did, particularly in southern Vietnam, of just how much money figured in those narratives that people had. And so when I went back to conduct my field work, I thought of using money as an organizing device, particularly because it seemed to be money that was drawing so many people to Ho Chi Minh City at the time. And of course, people talked about it as kim tiền, or more basically as kim cơm, that is, that you're actually looking for rice, you're looking to nourish yourself, you're looking for something to survive. And so my approach of looking for money was a little bit different, because money became this object for understanding how money was reshaping people's social relations and reshaping how they understood themselves in Vietnam's changing economy. So that was what drew me to Ho Chi Minh City, and trying to figure out those dynamics were what kept me in Ho Chi Minh City.
And you say that money is not ordinarily used by ethnographers as a device for understanding the world that they're in and that they're researching. Why is it that money seems to have been overlooked, or having spent so much time thinking about this problem of money yourself? What are the reasons that in your opinion, money has been neglected as an analytical tool?
Well, I think that has certainly changed over the past decade, that there has been a revival, because, of course, money was a topic for ethnographers, or thinking about valuables, thinking about what were the objects of exchanges and transactions, how people symbolized credit. Certainly been a longstanding ethnographic question. And money has become increasingly an object of interest for ethnographers. Everything, of course, from thinking about national currencies, which I was concerned with in this book, as well as Bitcoin, digital and virtual currencies. But I think that money has or was overlooked precisely because it was something that we assumed we already understood how it worked. And we understood it to be something which transcended national boundaries, that we understood what money was supposed to do. And of course, it infiltrates our lives in ways I think that merit ethnographic understanding. And so I wanted to take an object in motion, as it were, of course, because money is always in circulation, and understand those dynamics. But I think one of the reasons why it remains an elusive object of inquiry is partly because we think we know how it works, and partly because we presume, of course, that it stands outside of culture, that money is one of these objects in the marketplace and thus doesn't take on the kind of particular meanings that we often ascribe to cultural formations.
So what are some of the other meanings of money that you examined in your research that shed more light on the ways in which money works that you think are neglected in other research?
Well, I was concerned with, for example, how people handled money, how they carried money. One of the things that attracted me to money as a kind of material object was, of course, because during the time that I was conducting my research, Vietnam, most people transacted very much within a cash economy. That they were not using these kinds of condensed forms of transactions like a credit card that enable you to swipe and not worry about the kind of calculations where you're counting out different denominations and carrying the coins and having to deal with the kind of material objects of counting and recounting. So that was one of the things that attracted my attention. And certainly in working within a context in which people were dealing primarily with cash in this very physical form gave me something to latch on to for thinking about those dynamics. And I was interested, of course, in the play of denominations, particularly how people were commenting on what they regarded as the kind of worthless denominations that were in circulation in the Vietnamese realm, the national currency, and how they evaluated that in relation to what seemed to be the hyper-valued $100 bills, which were also in circulation. So those kinds of plays around denomination, I think, gave me a way of thinking about money in a way that would be not as visible in, say, the United States, where people have a much more kind of concentrated and standardized understanding of what money is in circulation.
You've given us a good sense of some aspects of the chapters that follow, but one other aspect of the work which I'd like to draw out at the beginning that I found very important and fascinating as I worked my way through the book was monetary pluralism. Can you explain what you mean by monetary pluralism and why it's particularly important for your research in Ho Chi Minh City?
By monetary pluralism, I wanted to capture what was at the time I was doing the research a very visible and palpable way in which people handled money, that they didn't handle just a single currency, but people were also transacting with dollar bills. They were purchasing and holding and sometimes transacting with bars or tails of gold, as well as the national currency, the Vietnamese dong. And I was struck then whenever I would pass through Thailand or Malaysia and I would attempt to use dollars, that I was just rebuffed every time. Oh, no, we don't take that currency. Oh, you know, why don't you go to an ATM machine and get some of the, you know, the local currency. So this monetary pluralism, for me, gave me another way of thinking about the way in which money in Vietnam was not consolidated into this single form, but actually proliferated in different forms. And even though people could buy and sell these different currencies, what I also wanted to capture was what were the moments of non-convertibility? What was the value that was signaled by the U.S. dollar that was not signaled by the Vietnamese dong? So even though, of course, people could buy and sell these different currencies, that I also wanted to capture in the ethnography some of what remained unconvertible across these different platforms of value.
Can you give us an illustration of this idea of unconvertibility?
Well, for example, some people talked about why they held on to $100 bills, for example. And the $100 bills operated for some people as a kind of savings mechanism because they were so loath to sacrifice that $100 bill. A few people would carry it in their wallet, for example. It was a kind of savings or almost an insurance device that money was, that they had money, but it was money that they were loath to part with. It was a form of value that they were reluctant to sacrifice. That in and a similar thing also happened around, say, $2 bills, which I found very fascinating. U.S. $2 bills, of course, were only printed in 2 years, which I think I talked about a little bit in the book, and that these $2 bills were often regarded as symbols of good luck. Now, of course, you could talk about the value of a $2 bill in terms of the Vietnamese dong. What could it be converted into? What was its value in relationship to Vietnamese dong? But most people felt like there was a value which was in addition to its monetary value. And that was what they wanted to hold on to. And so that dynamic of wanting to hold on to something other than its monetary worth in the marketplace was also what I wanted to capture in this ethnography.
And you do a very good job of capturing it through a number of cases and chapters organized thematically that we'll turn to in a moment. But before we go to those chapters and the current period, your first chapter explores monetary pluralism in the historical setting and the making of Vietnamese money over different periods in modern history. Can you talk us through those periods and how this idea of monetary pluralism and the practice of monetary pluralism is tied very much to successive governments and the interaction between states and markets in Vietnam?
Well, one of the goals that I had in that first chapter was to break away from a kind of evolutionary narrative of money in which people are transacting with these diverse objects, which gradually lead to a kind of commoditized form, let's say gold, that eventually becomes consolidated under the state and given symbolic value as a national currency. So I wanted to counter that kind of narrative, which emerges very much in relation to a kind of Western narrative around state formation. And I also wanted to counter the idea that this monetary pluralism erupts out of a kind of, let's say, failure of post-1975 governance of Vietnam. That it is the failed monetary policies in the Socialist Republic of Vietnam that give way to pluralism. So part of my interest in writing the chapter was actually to propose that monetary pluralism in Vietnam has much more historical depth and is related to the colonial encounters in which the French franc, for example, had limited circulation, and that coins that bared the imprimatur of the royal family were still in circulation. So my goal in that chapter was actually to work against two of those narratives. The first, of course, being that evolutionary narrative in which money just naturally evolves to this form of national currency. And the other was to actually show that some of these dynamics have been in play for a very long time in Vietnam. And so there are ways in which we can see historical processes of appropriation, reappropriation of these different forms of value. So I start, of course, then with trying to understand some of the dynamics around what is called, of course, the pieces of eight, or the Mexican silver dollar, which were a form of currency that was used in wide circulation around Asia, and actually for some scholars are what helped to produce a good kind of global trade. Anthropologists like Jane Geyer in particular have been interested in what she calls marginal gains. And she makes the argument, which I think is very important in understanding the role of silver in Asia, that of course that we need to understand how these notions of value are never universal, but they take on different values that are distributed differently across different places. So even though silver was very valued for these long distance exchanges, it was gold that was highly valued in Europe. So I was interested in those kinds of dynamics, and I was also fascinated, and this gets back to my interest in kind of the physical specimens of money. I was very interested in working with money collectors in Ho Chi Minh City. And there were a few people who I had the privilege of working with who had really interesting collections, particularly around the kind of currency that was printed after 1945 in northern Vietnam and in southern Vietnam, and the kinds of competing imagery around these national currencies, one in North Vietnam and the other in South Vietnam, and how people would respond when I showed them these old specimens of currency. So part of it was my pleasure in working with monetary collectors who were very generous with their time and their knowledge, and were very invested in preserving these material specimens of history. So I found working with them to be really helpful in helping expand my understanding of monetary pluralism as well.
From 1975, you talk about currency unification and monetary disunification. Can you explain briefly what you mean by that distinction, because it helps to set up the subsequent chapters of the book and our discussion very well, I think.
Well, currency unification, of course, by that I meant the fact that between 1954 and 1975, there was the National Bank of Vietnam in Saigon, and there was a separate national currency that circulated in the Republic of Vietnam with very different imagery and a very different presumption of how the value of that currency was secured than in northern Vietnam. After 1975, one of the tasks of course, reunification was what is the infrastructure that's needed for reunification, which happened in a variety of ways. The educational system, the train system, roadways, but importantly, money as well. And so there was a campaign to create a unified currency that would circulate throughout the entire territory of the Socialist Republic of Vietnam. But at the same time, there was also what I called monetary disunification, in the sense that there were two, possibly more, realms in which prices were configured. One of those realms was the state, and the other realm was what people referred to as being in the outside market, where prices were higher, but goods were available. And so that is what I meant by monetary disunification, or what some people refer to in the literature as a kind of two-price policy, where you had one realm in which the prices were set by the state, but there were shortages and scarcities that often people needed to have coupons in order to purchase things at the state-authorized prices. But then there was this domain which people referred to as being in the outside market. And so that's what I meant by monetary disunification.
And a feature of this monetary disunification, which I think you really draw out very well in this chapter also, is, and it runs then throughout subsequent chapters, is this disassociation between states and markets, contrary to assumptions in some literature of their mutual constitution. So maybe we can explore that further momentarily. We then come into the parts of the book concerned with ideas and practices associated with the use of money, or rather perhaps monies in Vietnam in the current period. Before we talk through some of the fascinating accounts that you have of how money works, can you say a little bit more about how you did your research on money in Ho Chi Minh City and the period of time in which you were doing it?
Well, the bulk of the field work that I conducted for the book was done in the period of 2000 to 2002. And I did my research in, I would subsequently look back and say, in a very haphazard way. And haphazard, I mean that it was based on interviews, it was based on conversations with people who were involved in monetary policies in Saigon before 1975. I talked to people who had businesses. I sat with them and I paid attention to how people were handling money. I was very interested in the kinds of techniques which I see among some Vietnamese living in the United States about how they would count money, they would fold money, the kind of warnings that they would give me about how I could tell whether particularly paper currency was counterfeit or not. I was interested in the kind of evaluations that people had around what it meant to where they saved money, how they held money, what they thought about spending money. I was also interested in just watching the everyday exchanges in order to get at some of the dynamics in play. I think one of the insights of ethnography is to slow down. That is, to actually see what people are doing in ways that we just don't pay much attention to as we go about our everyday lives. I think one of the things that I found about paying attention to money, of course, was how people would hold on to certain denominations and how other people, for example, one of the things I talk about was how casually some people would use very large denominations of Vietnamese currency, and how this placed a burden on some of the vendors to actually produce change for those large bills. So those were the kind of dynamics I think that would have been difficult to get at relying only on interviews, but became evident when I did, in a kind of classical ethnographic fashion, observed what people were doing.
And I think let's move to a number of the chapters now. We're not going to get through them all, but there's a great deal of very rich material that's worth looking at. And the chapters also, I should say, the titles are beautiful, like the title of the book itself. They're succinct, but they're also informative and evocative. So the chapter two you refer to as renovating households, two words, and yet both of the words, as the chapter makes clear, are enormously important for understanding the everyday economy and use of money in Ho Chi Minh City. So can you talk us through a bit of that chapter and especially highlight what you mean both by renovation and household as signifiers of something more politically and economically?
Well, I do have to say my hat is off to many of the anthropologists who've worked in Vietnam and have drawn in my attention in important ways to how the household is revived as a central economic unit in Vietnam. And I think this is a very important point, particularly when thinking about, let's say, consumer society in the United States or in late capitalist societies, where in fact a lot of the understanding or the ideology of around money is that money stops at the doorstep of the household. In Vietnam, I was very interested in understanding how, in fact, money moved in very different ways within households, partly through people's reliance on the remittance economy, certainly through the internal migration, which has contributed to the vast expansion of Ho Chi Minh City, in that people traveled to Ho Chi Minh City in an effort to improve not only their personal economic welfare, but also the welfare of their households. When I talked about renovating households, of course, I was drawing on what has become a kind of key event in understanding Vietnam, which is renovation itself, or Doi Mới. And by bringing those together, I wanted to counter then what again is one of the dominant narratives around money, capitalist societies, and that is how it stops at the door, at the doorstep of the house. Of course, there's a lot of critical work on this as well, but part of my effort was to show how money worked at a very intimate level in Vietnamese society, which merited, again, ethnographic attention. And so I wanted to locate the first, or at least set up a kind of dynamic around money within the household as a way of addressing the very intimate dynamics around the monetization of social relations.
Maybe you can illustrate the point with reference to one of the stories that you recount in the chapter. There's a couple that trade in pork down the street from the central market, money and marriages, and a story of a young woman who migrates to Japan for work and then returns to Vietnam. Perhaps I may draw on one of those to go into these points a little bit further.
Well, I'll draw on the story of the woman who migrates to Japan, which she was someone who I've remained in contact and have seen, of course, how her life has transformed after this migration experience. But one of the things that struck me was how heavily she needed to rely on her family in order to migrate, that her older sister had to use the title to her house as a guarantee that, of course, she would return to Vietnam. And much of the money that she made while she was in Japan was then actually brought back by the company owner and then given to her family to repay the debt. I was struck when she returned, and I'm not sure how much I was able to convey about this. I did have the opportunity to visit her in Japan. I visited her with an American friend who was fluent in Japanese, and our arrival, since I spoke Vietnamese and my friend spoke Japanese, apparently caused a lot of consternation because the owner thought that we were human rights inspectors. But I did have a chance to visit her and talk to her about just how much she had, she understood her role at that time in terms of earning money and how hard they worked. But when she returned, she, in fact, in some ways, was brought back into her extended family, that she ended up purchasing a house which was part of a complex owned by another one of her brothers. And she, in fact, returned to her position, cooking for the family, providing childcare. And when I last spoke with her, she had sold the house that she had bought, and that money was then used for her extended family to purchase what was a fairly large size villa, but she had no ownership in that villa. And I think she was just coming to terms with understanding what she had lost in terms of her own independence as a property owner by having sold her own house in order to put the money to purchase a larger house that then became someone else's property. So I think those dynamics for me were very revealing, that we do need to understand how money moves through families, how it shapes kin-based relations in important ways. And so her life history and her ongoing, in a sense, quest to both maintain her moral sense of belonging within the family, but still find a position outside of these family structures has been very moving for me to witness and to talk to her about over what's now more than a decade.
And her story also goes to a couple of other themes that work their way across the book. One is territoriality and what it means to relate money to a particular territory or otherwise. The other one concerns what you describe as the dollarization of the economy, and partly due to remittances, but for other reasons as well. So there are two chapters where the dollar figures very prominently in the discussion, one on dollarization and the other, perhaps somewhat to my surprise, when we move into the spirit world. And please tell us a bit about why dollars matter and how they relate to the larger problems with which you're concerned in the book.
Well, I think scholars, tourists, in some ways, people who are Vietnamese themselves, of course, comment on the appearance of $100 bills as a value form, a kind of representational form that people use to mediate with the spirit world, whether it's in making offerings to spirits of temples or gods or ancestors. I was struck on several occasions by the ways in which people would comment on the quality of these of spirit money in the form of $100 bills, that people would often comment on it as, you know, that this is a very high quality spirit money, and this you can only buy in the cities, or this actually is a perfect imitation of a $100 bill. It didn't have on the obverse side the expression in Vietnamese which indicates that this is from the Bank of Hell. No, it was actually a perfect imitation, and so people felt a kind of anxiety around whether this could actually be seen as a counterfeit $100 bill. So my interest in that was actually to complicate this divide between what we might think of as money circulating in this world and forms of money that were destined for the other world. Because people actually felt a very kind of palpable anxiety around the appearance of these $100 bills that were intended to be offered and burned and their value sent to spirits. So one of the things I wanted to capture was that kind of anxiety. And it became clear in talking to even a government official who remarked on what he saw as a kind of way in which the offerings made at the grave sites of fallen soldiers who had fought to liberate southern Vietnam, that these $100 bills were illicit, that they should not be left on these altars, even though, of course, one could argue that they signified something very important for those people who were making the offerings. So I was very interested in understanding those kinds of conversations that were happening around the appearance of $100 bills, where it was seen as legitimate and where the appearance of these $100 bills was seen as illegitimate.
How and why did we get to this situation where the dollar figures so prominently in the use of money and the meaning of money in Vietnam? You mentioned that after 1975, the US dollar was contraband, and yet by the early 1990s, approximately 40% of bank deposits were in US dollars. It's a remarkable story, and what you succeed in doing in the book is really telling how there are many layers of meaning associated with that story, that as you reiterate throughout the book, that this is not just a story of financial transactions, but of so much more. Can you explain a little bit more about the dollarization phenomenon and what it means for Vietnamese?
Well, in the book, one of the things that I do try to trace it to is the way in which, of course, as you had pointed out in one of your earlier questions, that the state and market are not constituting each other, but rather that money became a way of eluding the state, and that people were drawing on this kind of market potential as a way of avoiding or escaping the kinds of restrictions that were placed on consumption, that money became in some ways an alternative to the state-designated categories of personhood. And I think it's at that point where we can understand the role of the dollar, not as the U.S. dollar, but as the global dollar. But at the same time, I was interested as well in the fact that, of course, it did have resonance as the American dollar, the U.S. dollar, because, of course, you have this channeling of money from the diaspora in the form of overseas remittances. But as I argue in the book, it's equally important to understand the kind of global dynamics around dollarization, because the dollar in some ways escapes the control of even the U.S. Treasury and the Federal Reserve. And so it signifies then this global marketplace, and people fashion themselves insofar as they want to demonstrate their membership within this kind of global understanding of subjectivity, one that isn't entirely indebted to understanding oneself in national terms or nationalist terms, but rather draws on the potency of global markets. And the dollar, at least at the time that I was conducting my research, was the preeminent way of fashioning oneself, more so than gold, although that, I think, changed with the increase in the price of gold after 9/11. But during the time that I was conducting most of the research, I think what I tried to understand was that the dollar had these two sides. It was, yes, it was the U.S. dollar, but it was also importantly a global currency that couldn't be completely tethered to the United States. Another a thing that struck me, and this is, I think, where interviews are so very important in listening to what people say, is I was quite surprised when I would ask people, which was one of my standard interview questions, when did you first hold an American dollar? When did you first come into contact, or do you first recall seeing a U.S. dollar? And I was really surprised that most people talked about handling U.S. dollars in the 1980s. I had expected it to be much earlier, which isn't to say that dollars weren't in circulation, but as I argue in the book, that the U.S. military actually created a kind of military script that people referred to as red dollars, which was in circulation, and that the appearance of dollars in the Vietnamese economy in some ways is important to link with what people perceived in the 1980s as a kind of failure of the Vietnamese currency with hyperinflation. And of course, the remittances, which were a very important way in which people were coming into contact with dollars as they were sent in. People were sewing them up in the jeans of their clothes that they sent to family and friends in Vietnam. They were rolling them up inside of tubes and radios. So there were multiple ways in which these dollars really began to resurface in the 1980s. And so I was very interested in that dynamic because, as I said, my initial reaction was that people would have come into contact or handled dollars much sooner than they did. It was really many people located it in the 1980s when they first started handling dollars.
Some people might be surprised that our discussion so far has barely, perhaps not at all, referred to the Communist Party and its place in all of this. I don't think we're being remiss. Indeed, the party moves in the background of the stories that you're telling and perhaps emerges only at a couple of key moments towards the end of the book in relation to other state institutions, such as around the buying and selling of land. But how does the party engage with this issue of dollarization? And you mentioned the failure of the Vietnamese currency at a certain period. And what are the implications for it? You do talk a little bit about how monetary pluralism, in a sense, challenges the state and its representations of self. So if we can explore that aspect of the book briefly before closing, it'd be great.
Well, I think that the role of the state is critical at several moments. And one of those moments was when the Vietnamese State Bank encouraged banks to actually allow people to deposit, to open U.S. dollar-denominated accounts. And so that actually led people to open up these accounts in order to build a domestic credit market. So I think that was one way in which there were official policies that recognized U.S. dollars and gold as quasi-official currencies in circulation. One of the dilemmas, of course, was that in order to rebuild people's confidence in the U.S., in the Vietnamese currency, that the State Bank of Vietnam had to, in fact, peg, not a hard peg, but a kind of soft peg of the Vietnamese dong to the U.S. dollar in such a way that people would begin, in a sense, to move from holding dollars to using the Vietnamese dong, which has been moderately successful, but still there is a way in which the monetary policies in Vietnam are still, I don't want to say held hostage, that's not the right term, but still have to reckon with the monetary policies of the Federal Reserve. So we can see, of course, that this has some implications for how much sovereign authority the Vietnamese government is able to have in terms of shaping monetary policy. So dollarization in Vietnam has been, in some ways, acknowledged by the government by allowing people to hold U.S. dollar savings accounts, and by authorizing venues like gold shops as being places where people could buy and sell across these multiple monetary forms.
And you talk about the relationship of the state and the party to these changes, not only in terms of its practices, but also ideology. So while on the one hand, the party insists on maintaining political and administrative power, we see a reordering of concepts, if I recall it correctly, from strong people and rich country to rich people and strong country, a subtle lexical shift, and yet an important one, again, for the story you're telling. Is that correct?
Well, yes, I think this is one of the dynamics that anthropologists working in both Vietnam, particularly China, have made an argument about how, in fact, wealth needs becomes, in effect, something that people can pursue. Anthropologists like Anne-Marie Leskovich, who have worked with vendors, are more cautious and argue that, of course, the displays of wealth are more socially legitimate when they're happening in relationship to consumption rather than production. And so this is a kind of element, I think, which is important to take into account, but that shift in which people can make and display status objects like dollars, like motorbikes, become very much part of the street scenes in cities like Ho Chi Minh City. And so money is an important element by which status becomes displayed.
And you have a wonderful story towards the end of the book of a purchase of a motorcycle from a motorbike dealer, a kind of activity that goes on every day, and yet it seems to catch up so many elements of the book's contents. Again, the use of multiple currencies, the aspirations of the person purchasing the motorcycle to something more expensive than what they can afford, and so on. The many plastic cards that the vendor has in his possession, but none of them credit cards or cards of the sort that people in the United States or Australia, where I am, may hold in their wallets. Really, there's so many more elements to this story, but people are going to have to turn to the book and to go further into it, and indeed I would encourage all of the listeners to do so. Before we came online, you mentioned that you're in the thick of working on a new book right now. So can you please take the time to tell us about what you've been doing since you completed Dreaming of Money?
Well, I have two projects that I'm working on. One, of course, comes from Dreaming of Money in Ho Chi Minh City, and that is a social history of gold in Vietnam. I feel, in retrospect, when I look back on how I was thinking about gold, I subsumed it under the U.S. dollar. I feel I made both a kind of historic and analytical error in doing so. And so my more recent field work in Ho Chi Minh City has been on kind of changing practices around gold. I talk about dollarization when I was in Vietnam in 2012, and people were talking about the ways in which gold had reshaped monetary policies and the ways in which the Vietnamese state bank was trying to, in a sense, remove gold's role as a form of money. So I have that as a kind of project that emerged out of this initial book project, but I'm working on a second book project based on Vietnamese Buddhist communities in the Gulf South region of the United States. So that is a project that has taken me from Western Louisiana to the panhandle of Florida. So I have been interested in looking at the kind of politics around creating and maintaining Buddhist communities in the Gulf South, which is a very kind of fragile ecosystem with a threat of hurricanes, and a region that has not received a lot of attention within Asian studies. A lot of the work has been done on the East Coast and the West Coast. So I have been interested in making a contribution by looking at these communities in the Gulf South region.
So in a sense, that does also build on this book in so far as the story of what the transnational dimensions of the book are an important part of the story you're telling, remittances you've referred to. But as you've raised gold, I can't help but take a moment to dwell on it before we close. You do mention in the book that you think about gold in terms of intergenerational transfers especially, and its function as a store of private wealth, as against the US dollar as more of a contemporary transnational phenomenon which evokes different feelings. So are you saying that you've changed your view on how you've situated these two commodities in the book, or you're developing the story of gold further?
No, I mean, in part, that kind of claim came out of interviews, particularly with older Vietnamese who would often chastise their adult children for saving in dollars. And even at that time, before gold began its remarkable increase in price between 2001 up to 2011, 2012. And so I was very interested in how people conceptualized gold in terms of something that had this enduring value, that was linked to real estate, that was linked to property, was very much kind of rooted in this kind of substance. And they evaluated dollars quite differently. But part of my interest in a social history of gold is to understand, of course, how it was so important in mediating this flight of people from Vietnam. Many people talk about how they paid for passages in gold rings and tails of gold. And I'm also very interested in what I don't think that I really did justice to, the importance of a form of gold produced by the Saigon Jewelry Company, which really introduced a new form of gold to the market in the very late 1980s and early 90s. And so part of what I'm interested in is really looking at that market device and how today the State Bank of Vietnam is, in fact, trying to, it can't demonetize that device because it is so widely held. There are apparently estimates that there have been 20 million of these small gold bars that have been produced. It, of course, can't be demonetized, but it has led to some very, I think, interesting discussions around the use of gold as a form of money. So those are some of the dynamics that I have been looking into in this kind of subsequent part two version of the book.
Fascinating. Well, Alison Truitt, do let us know when the gold book is out, and thank you very much for taking the time to speak to us today about Dreaming of Money in Ho Chi Minh City.
Well, I was delighted to do so, and I thank you for engaging me in this hour-long conversation. I enjoyed it very much to rethink about some of the issues raised in this book, and I appreciate your invitation.
Well, I've greatly enjoyed it as well, and thanks to everyone for listening. Do join me again next time for our monthly meeting with an author on new books in Southeast Asian studies. And if you have time, you may also like to check out some of the other great channels in history, politics, and area studies on the New Books Network. Hey,